The aim of the following lecture, of course, is going to quantize 3D gravity. Okay, and for that, we are going to apply the Dirac program to 3D gravity. But the Dirac program is a canonical quantization. Okay, so this means first we need to understand the canonical formulation of gravity, and even before that, I want to just focus on, before talking about gravity, I just want to focus on what is the canonical formulation for a constrained system. And so in particular, today we're going to come back on the two examples you have seen in the tutorial, and on a bit artificial example, which is a parameterized particle, but you will see that this particular example has really features that are very similar to what we will get for gravity. So first, I just want you to think about these two questions. And we're going to start with the first one. So you know, why are we interested in constrained systems? So as I said, the aim of the lecture is going to quantize gravity. And so maybe first you can think that, so in physics, it's very common to describe a system using more variables that are needed. For example, it's very common that if you look just to a pendulum, that you can describe it using the x and y coordinates, whereas it has only one degree of freedom. So in this case, you understand that, of course, the x and y coordinate will have to be constrained because you have x squared plus y squared is equal l squared. Okay? So it's very common that in physics, we use some coordinates, more coordinates than we need, and then of course, these coordinates need to satisfy some constraint. But so in the context of general relativity, so in four dimensions, how many degrees of freedom are you expecting?
Four dimensions?
Yeah, in four dimensions. Yeah, okay. You have the two polarizations for the graviton. So we expect 2 degrees of freedom. But so usually, how do you describe general relativity?
The metric.
Yeah. So for example, if you use a metric, how many components here do you have?
10.
Yeah, 10 in 4D. Okay. And so already here, you can see that indeed, general relativity is a constrained system. So that's why we're interested in studying a constrained system. And even more so, then we're going to work, as I said, so we will, one step we will be to rewrite gravity using other variables than the metric variable. So we're going to work with a tetrad and a connection. And if you work with a tetrad, you even have more component because you have a tetrad then is going to have 4 space-time components and 4 internal components. Okay, so you have 16 then components. And of course, so this is in 4D and in 3D, so you expect 0 degrees of freedom because it's topological theory, the metric. But of course, your metric has more than 0 degree, is has just 6 components. And if you work with a triad, what we're going to do, then we even have more components. Okay, so you can even already guess that going from the metric formulation to the Palatini formulation, which is written in terms of a triad and a connection, we will add an additional symmetry here, an additional constraint, okay? You can already guess that from here. So yeah, this is going to answer the first question, why are we interested in constraint system in the particular case of doing some quantizing gravity? It's because, yeah, GR is really a constraint system. And of course, so what does it mean that we have constraints? This means that we have equation of this type, okay, between the phase space variable. And so now to go to the second question, can we relate constraint to gauge symmetries? So first, can we just relate constraint to symmetries in general? Of course, so this kind of equation, as you have seen yesterday in the tutorial, has to hold over time evolution, okay? So this means that you want this to be, so this means that this has to be also a constant of motion. Of course, it's a constant of motion equal to 0, but it's still a constant of motion. So I guess right now you're more familiar maybe with the Lagrangian formalism. And in the Lagrangian formalism, you know that from Noether theorem, symmetries are going to imply constant of motion. And we're going to talk now more about the canonical approach, where we can see in the Hamiltonian formalism that constant of motion indeed are going to imply symmetries. Okay, so this is how we're going to relate them. So now just a few words about really what I mean by a gauge. So what is now going to be really important is we need to distinguish between global symmetries and gauge symmetry. So in the Lagrangian formalism, you have seen that. So what does it mean that it's a gauge symmetry? This means that this has to be local. So then the parameter of your symmetry here in the global symmetry are going to be constant, whereas here you're going to deal with some function of your space-time component, and you have some local parameter. So let me just write explicitly what I... So a gauge symmetry is a local... and non-trivial transformation. So what does it mean by local? Here I mean that the transformation is not going to affect any boundary value. Okay. So what does it mean in particular? And this, you already seen that. You're already familiar with that, I guess. This means that now, if you have some initial boundary value or initial value problem, then this would mean that it doesn't have a unique solution in the presence of gauge symmetry. Okay, so this is a, and so by non-trivial here, I mean that this is going to act non-trivially on the extrema. Does this mean on your solution of the action? So, and so this means now that extrema are not proper extrema, but they feature in general some gauge direction along which the action is going to be constant. And so indeed in gauge theory, you know that solutions are not unique, even if a boundary or initial condition are fixed, okay? Yeah.
Can you explain this local arrow not affect boundary value, please?
Yeah, so what does it mean by local? So this means that the symmetry is not going to affect the boundary condition or the initial value. Okay, so it's just going to affect if you want the bulk, or so it's acting locally. Okay. So yeah, and so as a consequence, this is like here. This means that you can have solution in a gauge theory are not unique, even if boundary conditions are fixed. And so solutions which are mapped into other solutions by a gauge transformation are going to be physically equivalent or gauge equivalent. Okay. This is for gauge theory. Okay, so now how do we deal with constraint when we are in the canonical formulation? Okay, formalism. So I'm not going to review again the Hamiltonian formalism. I think you're all quite familiar with that, but just to remind you, so you start with an action written in terms of a Lagrangian, okay? And just very quickly, to go to the Hamiltonian formalism, you do this Legendre transform. And the first step, of course, is to compute the momenta associated to each variable. But so this means that now you have your given momentum as a function of your velocity, okay? And so what happened is that this in general is invertible, but it's not always the case. And when it's not the case, this means that, so, okay, so this means that here you have p as a function of qe dot, and can you express qe dot as a function of pi? So this is not always the case, and when it's not invertible, this is the case where you end up with what we call a primary constraint. And of course, what is really important here, so this constraint is going to be a function of your phase space variable, and you can have several of them, depending on how many of your momenta are not invertible here, how many of this function are not invertible. And so what is then the idea is that instead of, so you can build your usual Hamiltonian, just defining the usual way, so it's just qi pi minus the Lagrangian. But here now, since we are interested only in what is happening on the constraint surface, you can of course add, the recipe is to add some Lagrange multiplier and to add your constraint like this, okay? So this is the Hamiltonian you're going to work with, where here, these are your primary constraint. And this primary constraint really come from just defining your momenta, okay, here. So now, what is the question? So you see that now we don't have one unique, a priori, we don't have one unique Hamiltonian. Okay, we have a whole set of Hamiltonian depending on this variable. So now the question is, which one is the right one? Are we allowed to, are we free to choose the one we want? Or do we have several one? And the answer is going to be, it depends which kind of symmetry, which kind of constraint you have here, which is related to which kind of symmetry. Okay, so in the case where these constraints are going to be, we're going to see that in a moment, are going to be second class constraints, then this means that this u are going to be fixed. And in fact, this means that you are only dealing with a global symmetry, whereas in the case of gauge symmetry, these constraints, these are going to generate what we call first class constraint, okay? And this u are going to be free parameter. So you see already here that what does it mean? This means that now if you start from with some initial condition, now you have several ways to evolve your state, okay? So of course, with under gauge transformation, you see that it would be a unique evolution, okay? So let's go back to the two examples you have done in the tutorial yesterday quickly to just see the differences. And what is really important here . So these are the two examples we were dealing with yesterday. So the first one physically is very simple. It's just a particle moving on a circle, okay? And of course you see that if you stay in the Lagrangian formalism, if you look at the equation of motion, one of the equation of motion is give you that q1 squared plus q2 squared is equal to r squared. Okay, so that indeed this particle has to stay on the circle of radius r, is constrained to stay. But no, so this is from the Lagrangian formulation. So now let's go to the Hamiltonian formulation. So the first step is to compute the associated momenta. So here, you don't have any issue defining p1 and p2. It's just going to be equal to mv1 and mv2. But now if you compute p3, okay, you get that p3 is equal to 0. Just looking at this equation. And so of course, this means that you cannot express q3 dot as a function of p3. This function is not invertible. So you get a primary constraint. Okay, so now you're going to implement this primary constraint in your Hamiltonian. So your Hamiltonian is really. And then what is really important is that, so this is going, so you start from a phase space. So your phase space here is six dimensional, okay? And you have some, you have a constraint, okay? So it's going to reduce your phase space. So you, in fact, what you're going to have here is the primary constraint surface. And you want to stay, every solution has to lie in this surface, okay? So you want to stay in this surface. So this means that you want that this is a constant of motion. So you want that the time evolution of your constraint, which is given by, has to be equal to zero. And of course, if you remember, if you compute this, you don't get that this is equal to zero. So this here, you get something different from zero. You get what we're going to call C2, which is what we call a secondary constraint. Okay, so this constraint comes from the fact that you want that your primary constraint stay a constraint, or that is a. Okay, and so you can go on with this analysis until you, because you also want that this is a constant of motion. So you do again the same analysis, and you're going to see that again. This, when you compute, you don't get zero, but you get another function of your phase space variable, which is a tertiary constraint here, and so on and so forth. But here you can guess how many constraints do you need. Okay, so we start with a six-dimensional phase space, and what do you expect at the physical phase space here? At the physical phase space, so we have a variable moving on a circle, so you expect dimension 2. Okay, so this means that we expect 4 constraint. And so indeed, then you're going to find again that this is gives you another constraint. And then now when you compute the time evolution of your fourth constraint, what you're going to get is something proportional to your third constraint with some factor alpha plus U, which was, so U here is the Lagrange multiplier. And what you're interested in is that just this is equal to zero, but only on your constraint surface. Okay, it can be anything outside this constraint surface. So what does it mean? This means that you want this to be weakly zero. Okay, so this part is fine because this is zero on the constraint surface by definition. But this part has to be. So this you have to impose. That U is equal to zero. Okay, so you see that here in this specific example. So you start with one primary constraint, then you're going to show that you need 3 additional constraints. And at the end, you're going to show that this Lagrange multiplier here is fixed, okay? So you don't have any freedom here. You only have one Hamiltonian. And of course, here I'm going to come back to this example in a few moments when I'm going to introduce this notion of secondary constraint. That so here you have a unique evolution and you are not going to deal with any gauge symmetry, okay? So any question on this first example or everything was clear?
You're saying you're imposing that U equals zero. I thought there was like different indices on the U, like U1, U2, U3, like U4, each going with each of the constraints.
So here you have, so in the general setting, you can have, of course, several primary constraints, okay? Because you have any one primary constraint by equation which is not invertible, okay? Whereas in our case, we only have one primary constraint, so we only have one U. Okay, so that's why there is no. So here it's really the alpha is going to label the, but it cannot be the I because it doesn't mean, for example, in our example, we have 3 momenta, okay, and 2 are totally well defined, and the third one is a constraint. Any other question on that? Okay, so let's just move to the second example, where here you see that this Lagrangian, we could do a change of variable and define Q1 is Q2, and then and you can already see that this Lagrangian is in fact the Lagrangian for one unique particle defined with this position Q1. So we see that this variable is going to be kind of additional degrees of freedom, but which is going to be unphysical, okay? Because the Lagrangian dealing with your system is going to be that. And so indeed here, what is going to happen? So you have, if you compute again the momentum, you're going to find that P1 is equal to P2, okay? So this gives you your primary constraint. Now, you of course, again, you define your Hamiltonian by H0 plus U times this primary constraint, and you look at the time evolution of this constraint, and you're going to see that this is zero. So this means that you don't have, you have no more constraint, and you don't have any restriction on U, okay? So now what is the meaning of this U, and what is the symmetry associated with this constraint? Okay, so here you have a two-particle system with a Lagrangian where only, as I said, Q1, which in fact depends only on Q1. So the time evolution here, you can show that the time evolution of Q2, if you compute, is going to be totally arbitrary, is going to be given by U, okay? So already we see that here there is something unphysical. We have an arbitrary time evolution for these variables which do not enter into Lagrangian. So now the question is, what is the role of the constraint in this case? Is it going to generate some symmetry? Which kind of symmetry? So for this, what you're going to compute is the variation of your phase space variable associated with the your constraint. Okay, so here you have this, we consider that the constraint this, you have this parameter in front of, so this is going to be given by, and this is going to be U, then you get for P1, so we compute this Poisson bracket to know what is the transformation generated by this constraint on the phase space variable, and Q2, oh sorry, here it's a P. So here, what do you get? You get minus U. And
what do you mean by delta Q1 is equal to U, Q? I mean, what do you mean by this, those expressions?
Okay, let me just move this up to some. So this is a phase space function, okay? And so each phase space function can be seen as generating a flow on your phase space on your phase space. And so here I'm just looking at how this is going to, which is the flow generated by this constraint. And I'm looking in particular what is how it's going to transform the phase space variable Q1, P1, Q2, P2. But in fact, what I'm really computing here, so maybe what is not clear is that Okay, so this is what I'm computing, but this is weakly equal to, because the other term is going to be, so indeed this is a phase space function, so it depends on your phase space variable a priori, but this is weakly zero, okay, because this is a constraint. So this is weakly zero, so I don't, since I'm interested in the transformation of this variable on the constraint surface, okay, I can forget about this part.
Delta Q1 is the variation of Q1 if you add the perturbation U phi.
Yeah, so what is the way that this function is going to transform your variable Q1, okay? So as, so you know that Q1 H, okay, gives you the time evolution. Oh, sorry. But now here what you can do is really define you can really see that as, because so if you write this explicitly, okay, if you expand what is your bracket, you really see that this means that you look at the variation of Q1 under this.
What is
Q1? Well, in this context, since it's almost the same. No, it's not exactly the same thing as you get. But here in this context, the variation, this equation is almost the same as what we get for the time evolution. So in fact, it's in this context, it's the time evolution, but it could be different. Okay, it's you really look at the transformation generated by this constraint.
Say weakly zero,
do
you mean like on
shell? So weakly zero, so here it means on the constraint surface. Okay. So, and it's also what I was meaning here. So when I'm using this symbol here, this means weakly, and this means that it's on the constraint surface. So on shell would be more the vocabulary you would use maybe in the Lagrangian formalism. Here it means that you're on your constraint surface. And so you see that here you start with a primary constraint surface, but then at the end, when this is weakly zero, for example, when I add all my constraints, this is weakly zero on the physical constraint surface where all the constraint has been taken into account. Okay. Whereas you start with a primary constraint surface, and then this surface is going to reduce to end up to the what we are going to call the physical. But so let's analyze. So maybe we can, yeah, if it's not clear, we can maybe talk about that later. Just analyze these different equations that we have here. So you see that here it's going to leave the physical quantity, so the position Q1, big Q1, and the momentum. So what are my physical quantity, so Q1 and P1 here are left invariant under the transformation generated by my constraint, okay? But you see that it's going to change the what we can call the internal degrees of freedom. Which is here Q2, and here it's the change is given by, so this is change by so here what does it mean? This means that the kind of the time evolution that you can also see here consists with so a physical evolution of Q1 and P1, and you have this additional plus a transformation which is generated by the constraint with an arbitrary time-dependent
parameter here, which is u. Okay? So that, what does it mean now? This means that if you start from the same initial condition, the state can evolve into a different final state, since you are free to choose u. Okay, so this is the distinction between the two examples. And of course, if you want the physics to be deterministic, this means that you have to assume that two states which if we start from the same initial condition, which evolve into two different states, if they are related by a gauge transformation, so if they are related by this transformation, are physically equivalent. Okay, so this was what we have seen yesterday on the... So from these two examples, so any question on this second one? No, not now, okay. So on these two examples, we have introduced, we have seen different kinds of constraints. So we have seen the... So from these two examples, what do we have? We have seen that we have some primary constraint. And then some secondary constraint, possibly. Etc. Okay, you can have, you know. And so in the, to conclude, yeah, again, in the first example, there was no gauge degrees of freedom and the Hamiltonian was unique. In the second one, the Hamiltonian was not unique, but was containing a free parameter. But so another distinction between constraint is very important, between the what we call first class constraint and second class constraint. So now, let's talk about this distinction. So are you familiar with what is a first class constraint and second class constraint? Maybe yes already. You should. Okay, so let's review that because, yeah. So of course, all this is useful not only if you're interested in quantum gravity, but any kind of so now let's consider a system with constraints big psi alpha. And so by here, I mean that we have all the constraints. Okay, so we finish the analysis of our system, meaning we have the primary constraint and if needed, secondary, tertiary, etc. So here it's all the constraints you have. So now we need to make a distinction. So among these constraints, if there is a subset of constraints so here it's a big one, so pretty the different. Whose Poisson bracket vanishes with weakly vanish. With all constraints. Then these constraints are what we call the first class constraints. So what does it mean here? This means that you want for any of that, the Poisson bracket with any other constraint is weakly zero. Again, so this means that this vanish on the constraint surface. So again, this means that when you compute this explicitly, at the end, if you get a linear combination of your constraint, then this means that this is weakly zero. Okay, because it has to be zero only on the constraint surface. So if you have a this constraint our first class constraint. And it can be shown in this case that there won't be any restriction on the corresponding Lagrange multiplier that you have here. And so all the first class constraints are generating gauge transformation. Okay? So gauge symmetry here. Are generated by first class constraint. Okay, so what? So here is just a subset of your constraint. They need to all weakly commute. The Poisson bracket has to vanish. Then, of course, at the quantum level, it will be a commutation, but here it's the Poisson bracket has to vanish. So now, in some cases, of course, this is not all your constraint. You still have some remaining constraint. So if we did not the remaining constraint, then you can check that the matrix or the submatrix defined by the Poisson bracket between all these remaining constraints is invertible. So if it's not the case, this means that one linear combination of this constraint has to be a first class constraint. Okay, so this means that, so this is in fact more a way to check that you have all the first class constraint, is that this, the remaining constraint need to be, this need to be invertible. Okay, so if this is not the case, this means that you're missing some of them. And you can show that in this case, the corresponding Lagrange multiplier are weakly fixed. Okay, so let's call them UM. And this other constraint are called second class constraint. We have the second class constraint and the first class constraint. So as an exercise, you can check that indeed in this first example of the tutorial yesterday, you can compute the Poisson bracket between among themselves and check that indeed the matrix given by defined like this is invertible, meaning that, and of course that none of this Poisson bracket weakly vanish. Okay, so there will be second class constraint. Okay, so why? So yeah, of course, this distinction is important because then depending on which, so even in going back to the Lagrange transformalism, you're not going to deal the same way when you have second class constraint than first class constraint. Okay, so this distinction is really important. So in the context of gravity, for 3D gravity or even 4D gravity, we are going to, in the canonical formalism, we're going to have only first class constraint. But when we're going to deal with the spin foam approach. In fact, we're going to use another formulation of gravity as one we're going to use for the canonical formulation. And in this context, you're going to have some second class constraint. And this is really one of the main difficulty why how to build a spin foam model. So I will come back on that. But the fact that we have second class constraint is really difficult to deal with, okay? Because usually then there is really some redundancy at the quantum level. So we are going to integrate too many to have too many constraints. In fact, if we impose all of them strongly, so we have some other way to impose them, but it's not so easy. Okay, any question on that? Yeah.
Do you mean UM are weakly fixed?
So weakly fixed, this means that their value need to be fixed on the constraint surface. So for example, here, we impose U has to be equal to zero, but more precisely, we impose U equal to zero on the constraint. Surface, okay? It can take other value outside the constraint surface. And because here what you want is this weakly zero here. Okay.
So here F2, 3, 4 are all secondary constraints.
We haven't shown that in the tutorial. You have just defined that as coming from the primary constraint, how they were defined. But if you check that you have some second class constraint in this system. Yeah.
Can both primary and secondary constraints be first class and second class?
Yeah, so here, when you do this analysis, you need to have all your constraints here. So the constraint I'm starting with are my primary constraint and all the other constraints I need right after. Okay. So usually, primary constraint can be first class. Only the primary constraint. Yeah.
If you have gauge symmetry, then it's a first class constraint.
Yeah.
If it's a first class constraint, then it's not necessarily a gauge symmetry. So it's not equivalent.
It's equivalent, I would say. But
they're equivalent. So if it's a first class constraint, then it's coming always from a gauge symmetry.
I think so, but I need to check. I don't have any. Oh, maybe.
I would also think so, but
yeah. I think so. Yeah. Any other questions here?
In order to talk about these Lagrange multipliers, so it has to be the primary constraint, right?
Yeah. So then. So the way we've done that here, we introduce only a Lagrange multiplier for the primary constraint.
Yes.
So then there are different approaches where you can also add the other constraint using Lagrange multiplier and show that everything is going to work the same way. But so, indeed, but in the case where you have second class constraint, the Lagrange multiplier of your primary constraint are going to be fixed. So in this case, your primary constraint is going to be, if you compute the Poisson, is going to be second class, and it's going to be the Lagrange multiplier is going to be fixed. Okay, but we're going to to see another example, so maybe it's going to become also clear how it works.
Do you ever have to consider the Poisson bracket of first class and second class?
So here you need to determine which one are first class. So you need to compute this bracket. So you're going to determine when this is true. Of course, you're going to compute all the Poisson brackets among all the constraints. Okay. So of course, when you have this, then what you're going to do is really beta. Okay, so you compute really all these Poisson brackets. Then you're going to end up with some of them are weakly zero. So this gives you the first class. And then the remaining one, you need to check that indeed when you form this matrix here, then it's invertible. And then you're sure that if it's the case, this means that you have all, you are not missing any of these first class constraint and the other are second class. Okay, so what you compute usually it's really, and we're going to do that in the context of gravity. We're going to compute the Poisson bracket. It's going to be first class, so it's going to be easier, but you will see that it's first class means that it can be expressed in terms of the other constraint. So it's not always so obvious to see that indeed it's a function of the constraint. Yeah.
I'm not really sure if it's possible, but can it happen that none of those are zero, but if you do like a change of basis when you define phi alpha twiddle and as a linear combination of the phi alpha, then you get easily the first constraint?
So you're saying that by a change of variable, you can go from first class constraint to second class constraint?
No, it's more like if you give me a collection of psi alpha and I do all these brackets and none is zero, and then I change the basis of my psi, and then I got a lot of zeros. Is it possible or it never happened?
Yeah, sometimes you can. So it's more going to be, you can, of course, do some kind of linear combination where this kind of brackets are going to simplify it in these cases. Yeah, so this can happen. Okay, so maybe I just have time to introduce the parameterized particle, at least to motivate why I want to do that, and then tomorrow we will do really the canonical analysis of this system, and then apply on that. I will introduce the Dirac program, and we're going to apply the Dirac program to this system. Like this, you already have an idea of what is the Dirac program, and then we go to gravity. So it's going to be in two steps. But I really think that it's good that you already see that, because then going to gravity to apply the Dirac program, it's going to take maybe not 1 week, but almost. So you're going to be lost in among the steps. Which step are we? What are we doing here? Whereas if I already do this example, hopefully you will have in mind, okay, where are we? What are we doing? Because, of course, for the gravity, it's not going to be, even 3D gravity is not going so trivial. So first, let's consider this parameterized particle example, and I'm going to explain to you why it is interesting. So in fact, it's going to be the simplest example of generally covariant system. And here, the idea is, so it's a bit artificial because I'm going to introduce artificially that the time parameter now is going to be, so I'm just going to consider a non-relativistic free particle. And so in non-relativistic free particles, the time is just a parameter, but I'm going to make this parameter as a dynamical variable. Okay, and this then is going to mimic really what you have in the context of general relativity, where all your space-time variables are, in fact, also kind of dynamic. So what is the idea here? So I'm going to, and we're going to show that this is a totally constrained system. So I'm going to tell you what it is. And in fact, this is also the case of gravity. And so, particle. So, like, then with this example, we're going to see that, like, so in general relativity, you're going to have the diffeomorphism symmetry. Then the parameterized particle is going to feature or gauge symmetry, which is by coordinate transformation of the time parameter. So let's first consider a free non-relativistic particle. So you just have, so this is just a function. And of course, where Q dot here is, so let's specify what it is because we're going to make this variable dynamical. So it's just one dimensional, so it's the simplest system you can have. And just let's remind what is the Euler So the Euler-Lagrange equation would be just that Q dot dot is equal to zero. So then you get, you can solve that, and you just get that the solution is okay, so this is just to remind you, because so now we are going to introduce an additional variable. We are going to extend our phase space. And then, of course, this means that we're going to introduce some unphysical degrees of freedom. So at the end, the question is, here we know what is the physical solution. Okay, so the question will be, how do we recover this solution? Because in the context of gravity, we are going to face this kind of similar problem, except that we don't know what is really the physical degrees of freedom from here, because here, so it's very simple. I introduce artificially my second, my additional degrees of freedom, but the way it's going to behave is very similar to the way gravity is going to behave. But so then the question is, how do we go back to what is physical? Okay, because we need to have a kind of recipe to get rid of what we call the gauge degrees of freedom. So what is the idea here? So here, this is very simple. There is no symmetry, no constraint, and this is just the time evolution of what we call an observable. So I'm going to come back on that. And of course, in non-relativistic physics, usually you assume that the parameter t corresponds to some external clock, which is not influenced by the dynamics of the system. So now, to mimic the background independence feature of general relativity, let's reformulate this non-relativistic particle by considering that t is also an independent parameter. Okay, so I want to introduce. Now I want to consider that t is an independent variable. So really, this is really to mimic the fact that we have this background independence feature of general relativity. Okay. So what does it mean now? This means that, in fact, I'm going to introduce an additional parameter, S, which is a kind of curvilinear parameter. So now you can have Q and T, and then you have something like Q of S, T of S. Okay. And so I'm going to introduce this additional unphysical parameter S. And so now I'm going to define what is the action for my parameterized particle, which depend now on Q and T. Q of S and T and F, of course. So now it's going to be 1/2 of M. I'm going to define the new derivative with respect to S divided by T. Okay, so how I do that, I just use the, so let me define. So now the prime denote the derivative with respect to S. Okay, so here, so it's very simple to go from here to here. You just use the chain rule to define this in terms of the S variable, and you just replace dt from ds. Okay, so you see that now my phase space was two-dimensional. Now my phase space is four-dimensional. So of course I have introduced an unphysical degrees of freedom. So what do I want to do now? An important fact now is that you can check. So this I let you as an exercise. Check that this new action is indeed invariant under reparameterization. And meaning that I can redefine S as S tilde, where this is a function of S, and here it can be any smooth function. So now you have a gauge symmetry. This function is invariant under parameterization. So this means that if Q of S, T of S is a solution, then Q of F of S and T of F of S is also a solution. Okay, so do I have time to start the canonical analysis? What do you think? Or I'll let you try to think about that for tomorrow, maybe? Or do you want me to do it quickly? Or maybe it's better if you try to. So what is the next step is to do the canonical analysis. Then let me just give you what we're going to do. Like this. Then, as I said, so here we started, we know what is the physical degrees of freedom. So here we introduce additional and physical degrees of freedom. So how to get rid of that? So the question would be, can we define what we call observable? Okay, so an observable is going to be a function which is going to commute with all the constraints. The Poisson bracket is going to be equal to zero with all the constraints. And the interest of this, so this is really important when you want to, in fact, it's what we're going to use, when we're going to quantize, we're going to use observable, okay? Because this is invariant under, there is no gauge degrees of freedom here. And so at least when we are going to quantize, we're not going to have any fluctuation around this constant gauge direction, okay? So this is going to be the aim. How can we define observable? What are the observable for this system? And then once we will have that, so of course you can expect that in this context we need two observables. Okay. And so we're going to see that we can recover everything here. So this is to get here, we're going to use also some gauge fixing procedure. And then once we have this, I'm going to be able to introduce the Dirac program and apply this to the parameterized particle. And finally, when this would be done, we will go to gravity and do the same thing. So first do the canonical, so first define which action we're going to start with, then do the canonical analysis of this action. What are the degrees of freedom, and then apply the Dirac procedure. Okay? Any questions here?
Why two observables?
Sorry?
Two observables.
So in the for this context here, because so for, it's for the phase space. So as a function of phase space, so here you want two. You have the dimension of your physical phase space will be two. So in fact, you will have Q, like more or less the Q observable and the P observable. Okay.